Levon Savunts, and this is episode 6 of Diplomatic Dispatch.
We did not take action to start a war. I have a simple message for you. On behalf of 35 million Canadians, we're back.
On December 11th, 1997, Canada became one of more than 150 nations to sign the historic Kyoto Protocol.
Delegates at the climate conference in Kyoto, Japan, may have been jubilant to finally reach a deal to cut global emissions of greenhouse gases. But reaction here in Canada has been less than enthusiastic. The leader of the Reform Party, Preston Manning, says many premiers are going to be livid with Ottawa for agreeing to cut emissions more than expected. Going into the conference, Canada had been prepared to reduce emissions from 1990 levels by 3%. In the end, Canada doubled that target.
19 years later, with Canada's carbon emissions still rising, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau put his signature under another pledge to cut greenhouse gases.
World leaders have signed an agreement that makes the Paris Climate Change Treaty official. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was among the dignitaries at the United Nations for today's ceremony. Though some of our own officials say Canada is on track to miss its modest greenhouse gas reduction goals, Trudeau insisted Canada will invest heavily and rise to the challenge.
Today, with my signature, I give you our word that Canada's efforts will not cease.
Fighting climate change was also the defining issue in the October 2019 federal election. So it's not surprising that barely a month after the elections, discussions about Canada's role in reducing global carbon emissions were quite high on the agenda of the summit on Canada's global leadership. The two-day summit in Ottawa brought together hundreds of foreign policy and international development experts, academics and grassroots activists, former diplomats and soldiers.
My name is Stephen Cornish. I'm the CEO at the David Suzuki Foundation. And I've come to this conference on Canada's role in the world in order to put forth ideas about greening our overseas disaster assistance, as well as our foreign policy writ large.
So let's jump right into it. What do you mean by greening our foreign assistance?
Well, I think we need to, we've taken big steps here at home. Our government, as you know, signed up to the Paris Accords to try to keep the world's temperature from rising past 1.5 degrees. And in that, we started big steps at home. We have a pan-Canadian framework that's rolling out carbon tax and clean fuel standards and building standards and transportation and really trying to get us moving towards a lower carbon world. But before Paris, we signed up to the Kyoto Accords. And the Kyoto Accords said that those who caused climate change have to help those who are suffering most. And we know that OECD countries, including Canada, have caused the lion's share of all the carbon in the atmosphere. And so we signed up then to extend technical support, adaptation support, and mitigation support to countries around the world. And somehow we've sort of forgotten to lift up to that end of the bargain.
What does it mean in practical terms? What do you want Canada to do, so, and other OECD countries as well?
Yeah, in practical terms, it would mean helping different countries to adapt and to mitigate their own carbon. So some of the ideas that we put forward, one was just on financing. On financing, we continue to finance heavy CO2 industries and fossil fuel industries through development banks and through our own banks. So the first thing to do would be to stop doing that so we turn the taps off and then use those financing mechanisms to extend green bonds to help countries be able to afford the transition to renewable energy and insurance, risk insurance, so that after storms, climatic events, those countries would be able to recover themselves. We also need to help them to lower their CO2 and to become more resilient. And to do that, there's a number of things that you need to do around cities. You need to make them decentralized from big grids, put them on renewable energy. You need to have agriculture adapt to the changes. And in some areas, you need to prevent flooding have them stronger in the face of storms. And you can use natural assets to do that. So those are some of the types of things we can do in order to really begin making a difference overseas as well as at home.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Diplomatic Dispatch, a podcast by Radio Canada International. Check out our other podcasts on rcinet.ca. You can also download them on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
When we're talking about reimagining or redefining Canada's foreign policy, one of the issues that is coming up more and more is the necessity of thinking about climate change as a foreign policy challenge. What do you think about it? How does Canada integrate climate change into its foreign policy thinking when it comes to trade, foreign aid, diplomacy, security?
So right now we do it in an incremental fashion, where we will link climate change to some other issues in our foreign trade, in our foreign assistance. But what happened is last year we had the report by the International Panel on Climate Change, which told us that we have 10 years now to reduce the global temperature rise and keep it at 1.5 degrees. And if we don't, we're heading to 2 degrees or above. And the difference between that half degree doesn't sound like much, but that's the difference between tens of millions of people being displaced, millions and millions suffering severe drought, many, many people suffering food insecurity. And so we have to start taking this like the emergency that it is. And that means we have to put all hands on deck, and this needs to become a signature issue, not a side issue that we deal with on the side. And we've had a tendency in this country to change our foreign policy every time we change governments and every time we get a new term and we bring on a new issue. And they're all very important issues. We've signed up to the Sustainable Development Goals, which are all important. And they range from education to health to jobs, so many things. But all of the progress that we've made on all of those areas is going to be wiped out by climate change. We see that just with one tornado going through the Caribbean, where 10 years of disaster assistance is gone in the matter of hours. And so we really need to marshal, and the way we went into whole of government approach to some of the conflicts we've fought, we need to put towards climate change.
What are you hoping this conference accomplishes?
Well, first of all, I think that all the organizations here, they are all working either domestically or internationally. Those organizations need to start calling climate change out. Many times when we're talking about people displaced, for instance, those coming up from South America, we talk about people either fleeing for economic reasons or fleeing violence in Central America.
The scene at the border. Dramatic pictures of the chaos in Tijuana, Mexico over the past 24 hours. Hundreds of migrants from Central America attempted to storm the U.S. border, desperate to reach U.S. soil. U.S. authorities and Mexican police took unprecedented measures to stop them.
But when we went and talked to those people on the ground, we actually understood that first, they were driven off their farms because of the changing climate. They could no longer make a living. And then they went to the city. Then they suffered violence at the hands of the gangs. And then they tried to go to the U.S. So we have to start telling the story for what it is and linking what is due to climate change with the other events so that we're socializing it. We need to be telling all of our donors, all of our stakeholders about what's going on in the world and about Canada's responsibility to help out. Because sadly, we've seen recently a rise in populism. We've seen a rise in worrying about our own victimhood. And we do have real challenges. We have sectors of our society that are going to have difficulty adapting to a carbon-free world, and we need to help them along. But it can't be an either-or proposition. We have a responsibility, a moral responsibility, to help the developing world adapt to climate change, and it's a climate change that we've caused. So we have a co-responsibility as well as a moral obligation, and we're seeming to forget that obligation. So the first thing is we have to label things for what they are, and we have to hold on to our moral imperative to assist others in need. Then we can start moving towards changing the policy and putting the money towards actually doing something. But for now, we have to get through the gate, and we're not even through the gate because we're attacking climate change like we tackle any other subject. And that's just insufficient and not enough.
You know, some politicians, Elizabeth May has talked about the need for a war cabinet to kind of this kind of mentality to tackle climate change.
The Green Party wants Canada to double its carbon emissions reduction target. Leader Elizabeth May unveiled her party's climate action plan today.
Climate change is not, I want to repeat that, not an environmental issue. It's a massive security threat, and it needs to be dealt with by government at all levels as a security threat that requires taking bold action. It's best done, if we can possibly do it, in a nonpartisan way, which is why, in a time of war, all the opposition parties were invited into the inner cabinet to make sure that decisions were taken and were not subject to becoming political footballs.
Well, I think it's a great idea. I don't think we're likely to do that, and that might sound contradictory, but we're not very good with early warning as people. If you live on the side of a volcano, you have to put the volcano out of your mind in order to go to school every day, make a living, feed your kids, and you're the one who's most at risk, but you have the least safe perception of that risk. Whereas the one who's farthest away, that can never be touched, has an oversensory load about the damage the volcano can cause them, even though they're not in its path. And we have this inverse effect right now. We've caused this volcano. Yesterday, Hamzi, the blogger from Africa, said that it was a climate monster and we had to tackle it together. And we have a big responsibility for having created that monster. The effects of that monster are ravaging communities and countries overseas right now, and we don't have the eyes to see it. It's ravaging our own Inuit peoples in the Canadian Arctic, and we don't have the eyes to see it. And sadly, I think it's going to take our eyes seeing it a little bit closer to the reality, which means that we'll lose precious time, and that's the dichotomy here. We still have time to turn the ship around. It'll take a long time to do that. If we don't start now, though, it only gets worse, only gets more expensive, and the suffering only increases. So I don't know how a conference like this will achieve all that objective, but I think it's important. I think that we have to all recognize what is happening, all take responsibility, ensure that we're talking about it, linking it to all subjects and all investments, and little by little, then we'll get there. There's a social scientist that has come out with a report on what makes change, what makes revolution that succeeds. And 75% of big changes have come about when 3.5% of the population has taken repetitive steps, has gone into the streets, has written letters on an ongoing basis. And so that's what we're trying to do. And coming here is one of those steps. Because the more people we can get, we already had 1 million young people in the streets at a climate march just a couple of months ago in Canada. If we can find the way to get people to take repetitive steps to remember what's at stake here and to continue to demand better and more from politicians, from business, and from ourselves, then we'll get to the war cabinet and we'll start to live up to our responsibilities of helping overseas. And the crazy thing is, if we reduce climate change, we're actually protecting ourselves. We're protecting our children from the same types of damages that are going to occur overseas. We talk about how costly it is. Well, we don't even have an option here. And how costly is it not to do something? It's only going to cost us more, and not only in money. It'll cost us in lives, it'll cost us in morality and ethics, and so many things. And it's just not the type of society that you want to walk into to try to purposely build a catastrophic future for the world. Is just not something that sentient, caring people would want to do. But somehow, as a collective, we're able to put it aside because it's very complicated and continue with our daily lives. And we have to find the way to change track and get to the place where we would have a war cabinet that would be making every decision with climate change in mind.
That was Stephen Cornish. He's the CEO of the David Suzuki Foundation. You've been listening to episode 6 of Diplomatic Dispatch. In the next episode, I'll speak with Peggy Mason. She's the president of Rideau Institute. It's an independent think tank. And we'll talk about Canada's role in global arms control and promoting disarmament. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to us by email. Our email address is english@rcinet.ca. And if you speak French, Spanish, Arabic, or Mandarin, make sure to check our other podcasts on rcinet.ca. You can also download them on Apple, Google, or Android podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. You can also sign up for our cyber magazine to receive a daily selection of stories from Radio Canada International and Eye on the Arctic. That's our Circumpolar News collaboration project with public and private media outlets from around the Arctic region. I'm Levon Sivuns. See you soon.